What's that? An economic bright spot? Well, yes, we have one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, it is the 13th of September. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Today was a really interesting day, macro economy-wise. We learned this morning, courtesy of the Census Bureau, that median household income in this country last year was up by a little more than 5% from 2014. The poverty rate, on the other hand, was down more than a full percent. As I said, an interesting and a good day. All of that said, however, regular listeners to this program know that perhaps the defining element of this recovery so far, month in and month out, year after year after year, has been wages and income that are stuck. So, what gives with that? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
Let's start with the upside.
First, woohoo, good news.
Tiziana Deering studies poverty issues at Boston College.
Anytime we see both the median income going up and the poverty rate falling or the number of people in poverty falling, you've got to feel like that's a good year and we're moving in the right direction.
Sheldon Danziger of the Russell Sage Foundation has been watching poverty numbers for decades. He says he was surprised to see incomes go up as much as they did, even though other economic indicators gave us a hint in advance.
So everything was positive. Higher wage rates, more work, more full-time employment, and that translated into both declining poverty and rising median incomes.
But, and here's the downside, these numbers don't tell us everything about poverty in America. Elizabeth Babcock runs Boston-based Empath, which works with low-income families. She says for those at the bottom of the economic scale, things might not be getting better.
At the bottom, what we see is that the incomes have been increasing, but the greater percentage of that increase has been due to extra hours worked, as opposed to the actual amount that they earn on an hourly basis.
So a second job, longer hours at minimum wage, or picking up a bit of cash driving for Uber or Lyft. People might be making more money, but quality of life may not be so great. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The CEO of Wells Fargo, he of the $185 million fine last week for employees who created fake bank accounts for customers. His name is John Stumpf, by the way. He told the Wall Street Journal today that the fault lies squarely with those employees. There is nothing wrong with bank systems or its culture. It's possible, though, that there is some fault due to retail banking because it is not what it used to be. Technology and competition and a changing economy have made what was once a fairly straightforward, even boring industry into something quite complex and massive. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that one.
You know, they used to write songs about banks and the loans they made.
You'll be part of railways through Africa.
Exactly.
Dams across the Nile.
I didn't say they were catchy songs. Anyway, the idea there in Mary Poppins was you invest your money and the banks loan it out to businesses, or in that case, imperialism, and that's how they made money. They do more now.
They sell insurance. They're involved in retirement, IRAs, wealth management.
Steve Bigger is with Argus Research, and he kept going.
Foreign exchange, or if you want to do wire transfers.
With all the ways retail banks make money now.
Service charges, brokerage fees, asset management.
Yeah, okay. So big banks now make half their profits from things besides basic lending. Lots of reasons for this. Competition, for one.
Recently, what's really accelerated it has been the low interest rate environment.
Jim Sinegal is a senior analyst at Morningstar.
In the old days, there was a joke about bankers. Borrow at 3, lend at 6, and be on the golf course by 3. Low interest rates have really hurt that business model.
In some ways, this is good for consumers. Banks become a one-stop shop for financial services, and they get to know you and offer you things you might actually need. David Hilder is with Drexel Hamilton.
It all comes down to building deeper relationships with a core group of customers.
But it can obviously go too far, like it did at Wells Fargo. Again, Jim Sinegal.
Over the last decade, really, the banks have been far too aggressive in looking for new sources of income. It's the same sort of thing that led to the mortgage crisis.
Banks are not what they used to be, but then again, nothing is. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Remember the really happy music yesterday? Yeah, it's not going to happen today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Instagram announced a new filter of sorts this week. Not one for your pictures, but a filter for the words that sometimes get attached to Instagram posts. It's called a keyword moderation tool. You list words that you consider offensive or inappropriate, and comments with those words will automatically be deleted from your feed. You just won't see them. It's a user-oriented decision that has some real business implications, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Instagram is all about sharing what's going on in your life, like where you're traveling or that great chicken and waffles at breakfast. But other people can basically say whatever they want about your pictures. That's led to harassment and abuse, not just for celebrities. Jonah Berger teaches marketing at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
Really, if you think about it, Instagram is kind of like a restaurant or a party. And if they don't monitor who's coming in and who's coming out, other guests may get upset.
Now, there are a couple of options. One new option is to let Instagram's algorithm screen out comments it deems inappropriate. Now, you can also create a custom list of keywords that will be hidden from your comment feed. Karen North, a digital media professor at USC's Annenberg School, doesn't think a whole lot of people will choose that one, though.
Instagram, like Twitter and some others, are sort of wide open. So when you start limiting your own feed, then that's fine, but you're there in part to share with a broader audience.
But this new feature could allow advertisers to block negative comments from users who don't like their products. And that runs counter to the spirit of social media platforms like Instagram or Twitter. Again, Jonah Berger.
This is the challenges brands have with social media, right? They're used to controlling the message. You're in a platform where you don't control the message anymore. And so I think brands would love to block some of those negative messages, but I don't think we're going to see that anytime soon.
Even more than Instagram, Twitter has long been a platform rife with verbal abuse and harassment, but it's also all about public unedited messaging. The question is whether Twitter will take a cue and broaden its moderation tools as well. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We are on Instagram. Of course, you can get us at MarketplaceAPM. In commuting news today, let's raise a glass to an old tradition. Connecticut Governor Dana Malloy said today the state is going to bring back the bar car on commuter rail service between New York's Grand Central Station and stops on the New Haven line. The cars went away a couple of years ago, but are coming back as the State Department of Transportation gets ready for a fare increase. We went down to Grand Central to ask commuters for their thoughts.
How I feel about it? I love drinking. I love trains. Two in one.
I think it's great because you can't talk on the train, so for people who take it every day and want a place to hang out, I think it's terrific.
Let's put it this way. I'd rather that there's another car that could be used for people who are commuting and seats than to spend it on a bar car. I tended to find that they were really crowded, hard to get through, and then there was spillover and folks got kind of loud.
I know there's a lot of people who actually take advantage of the bar car. Hopefully that will boost the revenue for the state. Hopefully that will increase the service also.
I'm spending $127 a week to commute, so I don't know, we'll probably add probably $30 a day onto that. I foresee mostly business people sitting there taking shots and, I don't know, just unwinding over a glass of wine. But, I mean, there will be those nights on the weekends when, you know, it might get a little vomity, kind of like a subway.
That was Russell Lesturgeon, Lisa Snyderman, Steve McAdock, Rose Motto, and Eric Potter in Grand Central today. Levi Sharp got the sound for us. Got your swing states in this election, the various battlegrounds upon which the White House rests. You've also got, in greater numbers than normal this year, swing voters, swing demographics, if you will, groups that are, in part or in whole, up for grabs. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has this look at one of those groups, an unusual one at that, white college-educated men.
We're talking about voters like Duke Burgess.
I don't know what I'm going to do for the president. There's just nobody to vote for.
He's walking across a parking lot in downtown Leesburg, Virginia. From North Carolina, college degree, he's an IT consultant, traveling on business, usually votes Republican. I ask him, so what are you going to do?
I find myself having to vote for the lesser of the evils, and I'm just sick of it, that our politicians are so corrupt that I can't trust any of them.
Duke Burgess is squarely in the new swing state, not as in the United States, but a state of being.
white, male, college-educated voters who can't make up their minds between either major party nominee.
So this is really a year of the neither, right? This is really the year where both choices sort of stink.
That's Cliff Young, president of Ipsos Public Affairs, a polling firm. He says there's always a block of swing voters, but I ask him, the last time there were a bunch of college-educated white men in that group?
At least in my experience, never.
Now, the top issue for this big new swing voting bloc, the economy. They want long-term economic growth and job stability. Another thing about these guys, Donald Trump's stump speeches don't move them.
Trump's message, it's very, very visceral.
This is Charlie Cook with National Journal.
Some people are more open to relatively nuanced arguments and weighing pros and cons, and other voters tend to see things in a more binary way, that something is either good or it's bad.
Cook says the first group of voters, the undecided white men I've been talking about, they aren't moved by that black and white argument. They want more information. Corbin Ayers is one of these guys. He's 24, works for a marketing company in Leesburg. He wants details on trade, foreign policy, from both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Anything that either candidate is saying, I'm like, okay, so how'd you get that conclusion? They're not giving us the facts, they're just giving us opinions.
Ayers says he'd just like to hear the facts. That would help him make up his mind. And there are a lot of Corbin Ayers out there trying to figure out who to vote for. Again, Cliff Young of Ipsos.
So the question is, so like, what is the percent this year of undecideds? It's much larger than in past years.
How much larger? Well, in 2012, 13% of voters were undecided. This year, it's about a quarter of the electorate. A big part of that is this new swing bloc of white men. Young says all this indecision means the election will be even more suspenseful and volatile than usual. In Leesburg, Virginia, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I just believed that video games were going to be a powerful form of entertainment.
Boy, was he right. The CEO of Activision straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so there you go. The Wawa's, of course. Dow Industrials down 258 points, 1.4%, 18,066. The NASDAQ down 56 points, 1%, 5155. The S&P 500 down 32 points, 1.4% there as well, 2127. Yahoo CEO Marissa Meyer is going to get a $44 million golden parachute if she leaves after Verizon completes its nearly $5 billion purchase of that company. That's according to a regulatory filing. Verizon shares off 2%, Yahoo down 1% today. Fashion Week continues in New York with shows all over the city. And with that as a backdrop, Coach discount to 2.5% today. Kate Spade up 0.8%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Activision Blizzard is a gaming and entertainment company, one of the biggest in the world, in point of fact. Think Call of Duty, World of Warcraft, Guitar Hero, among many others. Bobby Kotick is the CEO, the longest-serving CEO of any publicly held technology company, 25 years now and counting. Back in the day, Kotick was a software developer. Now, today, he is the new installment of Conversations from the Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Bobby Kotick bought a chunk of the company that became Activision in 1990 when, it should be said, that company was $30 million in the hole and basically insolvent. So, when we sat down at Activision Blizzard's headquarters in Santa Monica the other day, I asked him why he made that deal.
You know, I think there were a few things that attracted me to the opportunity. The first was I just believed that video games were going to be a powerful form of entertainment. And when I was in college, my freshman and sophomore year, I played Activision games. And so I'd known the company. I'd started a software company in my college dorm room years earlier. And I knew the franchises. I knew the games. And so against the advice of everybody I knew, who said, why would you buy a bankrupt video game company? Just start a new one if you, you know, right. More of a Silicon Valley mentality, just start the new one. But I loved the library. You know, I played
the games library.
Like Pitfall and River Raid and Kaboom. And these were just great games.
So what's your biggest challenge right now as, you know, this space and the internet and all of that stuff changes like every day?
I would say, you know, having done this for 26 years, the challenges haven't really changed that much. Other than I would say something that is a phenomena of the last 3 years. And that is we as a business have so many opportunities for growth, for expansion, for new kinds of content creation.
And so you got to pick one, right, basically.
We have to prioritize the ones that you have. But I have seen this increase in opportunity in the last few years that's come from a variety of things. But start with, for the bulk of my career, we made games for middle-class consumers in developed countries. So you had a $300 console, you had a $1,000 personal computer. We now sell in 196 countries today. And so the phone has really opened up all of these new opportunities.
So you got to be mobile. Got to be.
Well, the biggest part of the growth of the industry is mobile.
Does that mean bad things then for some of your legacy games that are traditional console games, like Warcraft and like Call of Duty and the big ones that people play on their couch at home?
Look, I would say there remains tremendous opportunity. We've always been a very platform agnostic company. So our attitude is if you have a display and a microprocessor and a way to control it, we'll create content that is great for you. And there are more places to create great content today than there ever have been before. And that gets back to prioritizing opportunities. But those franchises are enduring franchises.
Do you – and I ask this to the guy who runs the company that makes both Warcraft and Call of Duty but also like Candy Crush – and you can't get two more different games. Do you know a great game when you see one?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when you see something that is not ready for prime time or has like inspired creativity all around it. I remember I was in Kyoto and Mr. Iwata and Mr. Miyamoto, the two heads of Nintendo, said, we want to show you something. And I went in this room and there was a little table like this and there was an old TV, you know, like a tube TV. And he had these two wands, and he gave me one, and he took one, and all I saw on the TV was a pond, just like a little pond with water. And he gave me the wand and said, go fishing. And, like, it didn't take any thought. I just went like this, and all of a sudden I saw, like, the kerplop of the lure and the water splash, and I held the wand, and I was holding it. As I was holding it, the force feedback started, and I could feel the fish on, and I pulled the fish out. And I thought, this is going to completely transform video games because the idea that you have a physical experience, you know, it's a very visceral experience. And the controller is something that you do have this unusual visceral relationship to, but this was something really different. And I think the phone has done something very similar. Some of the big differences are the social components, which didn't exist. But the idea that you have this piece of glass that you could touch, that you can move, that has an accelerometer that can actually change the position, like those are these moments that are, you know, they give you that incredible energy to know that what you're doing is something that really has meaning and importance.
there's a question to be asked here about who this company is for, because you have, I think it's fair to say, gotten in some trouble in the past talking about got to make investors happy because we're a for-profit company, while gamers have said, wait a minute, you're making this thing that is our lives, basically. You have been called the most hated man in video games. I wonder if you've learned a lesson or two as this company has risen in prominence and your role in this community has increased, if that makes any sense.
I don't do this often, for starters. So, I rarely do it. I think there was a comment I made in 2008 that was taken out of
context.
Made
people go crazy.
But that's... it was all in the spirit of humor. And was at a conference where I made a comment to be funny and explain why we were hiring people from Procter & Gamble. But at the end of the day, I think we've always adopted a philosophy that if you create compelling entertainment, that audiences will find their way to it. And you do have a commercial responsibility. But the primary responsibility that we feel as a company is to our players. And my philosophy about who our responsibility is to has never changed.
Bobby, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Kai.
We've got about another 20 minutes or so of the conversation that I had with Bobby Kotick. You can get it at our Corner Office podcast. And if you happen to be a gamer, well, it's put up or shut up time. We've got a sound quiz on our website. See if you can match the sound to the game. It's at marketplace.org. The highest per capita rate of homelessness in this country isn't New York or California or Arizona, New Mexico, Florida. It is Hawaii. Homelessness there in absolute numbers is up 5 consecutive years. Molly Solomon from Hawaii Public Radio has one person's story.
It's a chaotic scene at Honolulu's largest homeless shelter. Babies are crying, children run in the street, as families line up on the porch outside waiting for lunch. This is where I meet Malia Durden. She's 19, from Kalihi, and used to be homeless. She's visiting her mom today, who still is.
You see it's like crowded and there's a lot of people here. And that makes it kind of like depressing.
Malia's mom, Rose, has been at this shelter for a little more than a year.
I don't think she thought that she'd be like 60-something years old and houseless. Yeah. You know, like, it's not something you plan for.
That's a lesson Malia learned 2 years ago. When she was 17, her mom, Rose, suffered a stroke.
She has slurred speech. She can't walk, without a walker anymore. And I feel like it has done some things mentally, too. And emotionally, definitely.
Malia says that stroke changed their lives.
I don't think I realized that just one medical disaster could really throw you off.
Unable to work, Rose had to quit her job as a cashier. Most months, the two of them struggled to meet the rent.
My mother was the only one working. We didn't have any family. It was just me and my mom. She was the point person that was taking care of the both of us. And so when she had a stroke, it's like that security was gone.
Eventually, they were evicted. With nowhere to go, Malia and her mom ended up in an emergency shelter on the other side of town. For the first time, Malia suddenly found herself sleeping on a mat on the floor.
It was just this level of like, how could this happen? And it happened so fast. I did not know any houseless people growing up. I knew people that lived in rooms, I knew people that had to live in their grandmother's house, but they always had a place to go. I didn't know anybody who lived in a shelter.
During this time, Malia started to cut herself off. She had been a familiar face at poetry slams, but she stopped going. She was too embarrassed. She wanted to stay hidden.
I only reached out to people who I consider like a resource, I told the people who needed to know because I knew that they could help me and my mom. I didn't want anybody to know.
During the entire time at the shelter, Malia was working, sometimes two jobs. Eventually, she saved up enough to move in with a friend.
And so that was the first time that I started living on my own. Right now, I'm 19, living in a room, paying $650 a month. Living the adult life. I didn't think that was going to happen.
Malia's adult life is not all joy. Her mother still lives in a homeless shelter, but she's determined not to let her past cripple her future.
I think it's something that I'm ready to talk about, finally, because I feel like I'm at a point where I can say, yeah, this did happen, but this is not my reality. My reality is something much better.
That reality could now include getting a degree. Since I met her, she's been working with a local nonprofit through AmeriCorps. With the help of a scholarship from the program, she may even get to go to college next year. And she's returned to poetry slams. She just competed in a national poetry competition in Brooklyn, the first person from Hawaii to be sent there. In Honolulu, I'm Molly Solomon for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which there is a joke to be made about a souffle falling or a cake not rising or something, but I won't. In what will come as a tragedy to some not small part of the television-watching public, the transatlantic transplant, the Great British Bake Off, is leaving the BBC. Two of its hosts are leaving the show. And the whole thing, honestly, is just a mess. Negotiations had broken down between the company that makes the show, Love Productions, and the Beeb. Thus, spotted on Twitter today was this thought, quote, Bake Off leaving the BBC is worse than when Britain left the EU, end of quote. And yeah, maybe. So it was indeed the Wawa's, the Dow off 258 points today, 1.4%, 18,066. The NASDAQ down 56 points, 1%. The S&P 500 down 32 points, 1.4%. Tommy Andres, Raghu Manavalan, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.